Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Devin.
And we're doing a podcast again remote.
I know.
It's just
I miss you.
I know. I miss you too. It's just like the good old days. This is like how we started. And then we were like, we both live in LA. We should do this at the same house. Even though there's ridiculous traffic, there's no excuses. But 7 days away is too much.
It's a lot. It's a lot for us.
Too much for me to be away from you. It's also too much because there's just so much bullshit that happens. Like,
okay, I feel like I stepped away from, like, the real world for 5 days to, like, wear cosplay, and the world fucking burned down. You know, we joke, like, you know, we'll stop, and Sarah will check Twitter, and I'm, like, making sure the world isn't on fire. She's like, right, right. But, like, seriously, guys.
Friends. And also, last time we had a break, we did a whole thing like, this is what happened while we were away. And I was like, Devin, we have so much on our outline. I can't even do this. It's just, this is all like 84 years ago in Trump years.
It's been 185 years. I upped the number because, you know.
Yeah, it's been longer.
Gotta continue the joke.
So Devin is back in Los Angeles after going to Comic-Con, which we will definitely talk about because Devin had quite the time.
I did.
I am in Berkeley with I'm staying with my mom, and I found the funniest thing. I guess I had a school project to write an autobiography when I was 7.
Yeah.
There's just so much life experience, you know, like just gotta write it all down. And oh my gosh, you friends, I found like a firsthand account from little Sarah about the carrot story.
The carrot story.
So how Devin and I met. So I'm just going to read it to you, because this is from 7-year-old Sarah. My first friend was Devin. We met one day when she didn't have a snack, and I offered her a carrot. She said no, but somehow we became friends.
Somehow we overcame the carrot differences.
All carrot odds, we became friends. Like, I thought you were down with the carrots, so I got that part of the story wrong.
Right.
But you were like, fuck this bullshit. I don't want carrots, but I'll be your friend.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay.
I feel like that's the, you know, I'm glad that 7-year-old Sarah had to write an autobiography then. You know, we are committed to the truth on this podcast.
I also, just really quickly, before we get into, like, our actual show, I have to read a little other excerpt. I was cracking up with my mom and my sister because 7-year-old Sarah was a little dramatic. So I was talking about my favorite birthday so far, which was my 5-year-old birthday. And I was talking about how, so I have a twin sister, and I was talking about how she had vanilla cake with vanilla frosting, and I had chocolate cake, chocolate frosting, like, so different.
We're so different.
I know. And then, so this passage made me laugh. So I said, for the past 3 years, Jen had blown out her cake first. That year, it happened again. This is so dramatic. My eyes were red with anger. And then I, like, quoted myself, like, what I'm thinking.
Right.
I said, I've never blown out the candle first, I thought. But I didn't say anything about it. Except for that one incident. That birthday was a birthday to remember.
Oh my god. I feel like you started your writing career early.
I really did.
Like at 7.
Yeah, and I just like love how oppressed my 7-year-old self thought she was. It was like, my twin sister gets to blow out the candles first every fucking time!
Birthday candles are no joke.
It's no joke. Anyway, friends.
Okay, let's go through.
We're gonna stop bullshitting. We felt like that was a fun thing to go through. So let's talk about what we're gonna discuss on the show. So, as always, we start with listener feedback and some general Hellbent updates. Block two is what we call motherfucking healthcare,
which I feel like is becoming a permablock.
It's like a semi-permablock. I mean,
semi-perma.
Yeah, it's good that we're able to talk about it because they haven't passed anything yet.
Right.
Knock on wood. But so much bullshit happened over there. So that's our second block. It's just all healthcare.
Yep.
Our third block is Russia updates, because that shit doesn't stop. I mean, it is wild, the things that happen when Devin goes to Comic-Con. Then we get into our gratitude check, and we're going to keep our listener gratitude checks. People seem to like it, and we love it. So we have a few from some awesome listeners. Then we're going to get into our Donald Trump dishonor in Dick Watery, because it's Monday, and there's a few people who we have some shit to say about.
Oh, yeah.
We have some shit to say.
And I had a really fun, and I'm being sarcastic, last minute ad, so.
Yeah, I know, I saw it happen in real time.
Yeah.
And then finally, we end the show with our action items, so stuff you can do after you listen to the show. All right, Devin, let's get into some listener feedback and Hellbent updates. We had some fun feedback in regards to our theme music, because last show, there was someone who said that they heard the Hellbent theme song, which is a song that plays at the beginning of our show, on a Spotify ad, and I was like, who is this fucking advertiser using our goddamn music? Like, let us know.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah, who the fuck is this? And Bernadette did some excellent sleuthing, and she tweeted us and said, quote, the Spotify ad that has Hellbent music is a jewelry store called Chained and Able.
Which I'm kind of like, I'm kind of down with that name. Like, a solid pun. Solid pun.
I don't think I get the pun. What's the pun?
Cain and Abel.
What's that?
From the Bible.
Oh, well, I'm a Jew. You know, like, I don't read the Bible.
Yeah, I think it's Old Testament, but don't quote me on that.
Okay. Don't quote me on anything, because I'm also a really bad Jew and don't read anything. I don't even know Hebrew. Okay, and then also Rachel added to that, quote, the Spotify commercial for Chained and Able used Hellbent theme music. My brain could not compute. British dude is not Devin or Sarah. So I guess we had a British person. That's really funny. I love that. It's like out of context.
So Dana responded to my font story, which is one of my favorite stories that I've ever found.
Do you want to give a quick overview of the font story for people who might not remember?
Yes. Yeah, so the Pakistani leadership is under investigation, and the investigation looks like it might hinge on the font Calibri because of documents that were submitted that were dated before the font was widely available.
Yeah, it's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. Anyway, so she said, hashtag Trump fonts equals wingdings, which is the pictures, silly pictures. But every time I see that gif of him showing a bill, I picture Comic Sans. That seems right. I'm with you there, Dana. It's Comic Sans.
Yeah. Comic Sans brings Trump down, you know, Comic Sans or wingdings, I'm down for that. Mm-hmm.
I will literally wear a dress covered in wingdings if that happens. And then Canuck Steffer said, y'all helped me find my voice as a feminist and got me rethinking so many of society's norms. May not always agree, but you've opened my world.
And I think it's Canuck.
And this is just...
Canuck Steffers. Because that's Canuck Canadian. Steffers. Canuck, you know.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah. But this kind of feedback is just, it warms the cockles of my evil Disney villain heart. Seriously, this is just amazing. I mean, and again, women, feminists, they don't always have to agree. And in fact, it would be weird if we all agreed all the time. But this kind of feedback is what keeps me going personally.
Yeah, I love it too. And kind of on a related note, I was talking to my sister the other day, and we were sort of discussing if we think men change their minds as a result of women's feminist statuses or conversations in real life. Because you don't really know in the moment if people are changing. Oftentimes people change later beyond maybe certain impact points. And I've had, a few men message me and say that I have, which is awesome. But honestly, when I was thinking about it, I was like, I don't write or raise my voice for them to hear me necessarily. I do it for me. And I also do it so that other women can feel like they can be loud mouthy broads too. And I'm sort of glad, we're able to pay it forward sort of in that way on Hellbent. It's
absolutely
us being so mouthy and cursing all the time and saying whatever bullshit that comes to our mind. It gives tacit permission for other women who might not feel, comfortable doing so. So I love that feedback too.
Absolutely.
Finally, so we're going to have another Patreon bonus podcast, and that episode will cover four different topics. So the first one is foster care as punishment, the new reality of Jane Crow. There was a really, really fascinating and
intense
story in the New York Times about foster care. We're also going to talk about how the CDC found that over half of all female homicides are linked to intimate partner violence. That's a topic we think is really important. And then sort of kind of along that vein, there's a really good report in BuzzFeed how Twitter is still dismissing harassment reports and they still haven't figured their shit out there. And then we have an Interior employee who says the Trump administration is silencing science on scientists on climate change, which doesn't surprise me, but I think it's pretty bold.
Not even
for,
a little bit.
For this guy to be speaking out. So that's what we'll be covering on Patreon. If you're a $5 contributor and up, you'll get access to that kind of content.
Okay, Sarah, so let's get right into it. We have a lot to talk about. First, let's talk about some motherfucking healthcare. So the Republican strategy on healthcare is kind of, you know, ever shifting and in flux ahead of this vote. So can you tell us like some of what's going on there?
Yeah, okay, so here's what happened after we recorded last Monday. Like, we finished the podcast, and then within a couple of hours, I felt like the shit we were talking about was like not as relevant. There's like so much
shit. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. We are a good luck charm.
We are.
As soon as we record, something big happens.
Something big happens. We think it's us, but really, it's just too much bullshit.
It's just the news. It's too much bullshit.
So after we recorded on Monday, so last Monday, a week ago, two more senators, so Lee and Moran, said that they wouldn't vote for the bill in its current form, which effectively killed that version of the bill, at least for like a hot second. Like, you know, everyone's like, ooh, woo, like Republicans, like dead on arrival. But then Mitch motherfucking McConnell said that Republicans would then proceed straight into a full repeal without a replacement, but that sort of key parts of the repeal would be delayed for 2 years. So conveniently after the midterm elections.
Right, of course. But and I think the best part about this story is that three Republican women, Collins, Murkowski, and Caputo, were like, hold the fucking phone. This is not happening. And they are against a repeal without a replacement plan, just like wholesale.
Yeah.
Caputo pointedly said, quote, I did not come to Washington to hurt people.
Which, it's bananas that that is like a revolutionary statement in 2017. Like, that someone who says, I didn't come to Washington to hurt people is like, wow, what an amazing thing to say. Because so many of your fucking colleagues, seems like it did. They did come to Washington to hurt people.
That's why they're there.
Yeah. So I just, it's just, A, that's bananas, that that is like a heartwarming statement. Two, I think we should take a moment to acknowledge that these three women who were excluded from the bill writing process, remember it was like 13 fucking Republican men who were writing the bill, they really showed their male counterparts who's actually fucking boss. They hold a lot of power here, and those dudes really fucking underestimated that.
Yeah, which is kind of like, did they just not think this all the way through? They can only afford to lose two votes, and there are three female Republican senators.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the math there is just, if you don't include them, you are going to get owned, basically.
Well, I mean, it's if you don't include them, you're not going to take their perspective into consideration, and therefore they're probably not going to support the shit you put in there because you didn't think about what they wanted for their constituents. So, yeah, that was a little bit poetic, I felt. But yes,
that was a whole lot of poetic right there.
It was a whole lot of poetic, and yet, okay. So here's the latest: Republican Senate leaders are expected to vote as early as Tuesday. So that's tomorrow. We're recording on a Monday. They're expected to vote as early as tomorrow to begin debate on this legislation to repeal or replace ACA, but it remains unclear which version of the bill senators are actually going to vote on. Like, they literally they don't know. Like, Susan Collins, she said on TV yesterday, it appears we'll have a vote on Tuesday, but we don't know whether we'll be voting on the House bill, the first version of the Senate bill, or the second version of the Senate bill.
What the actual fuck?
I mean,
are they doing with their lives?
It's like, it's so in line with how this process has gone, though. Because remember, Republicans have yet to hold a single fucking hearing about this. And they haven't accepted, they haven't involved Democrats in this process. When ACA was being drafted, the Democrats, I think, included something like 100 Republican amendments or some shit. Over 100. I mean,
well, and Mitch McConnell is also saying shit like, well, if we don't pass this, we're going to have to stoop to working with Democrats.
I know.
And it's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, that's how this works.
God,
is everyone works
forbid.
Together.
God forbid
that you work together.
Which, and that's so telling because, you know, I know especially Collins, for example, who is one of the female senators on the Republican side who, like, put the kibosh on the just repeal plan. She was like, I want to work with my Republican and Democratic colleagues. And, you know, studies have shown that women in elected office get more stuff done than their male counterparts, and partly because they actually do work across the aisle.
Right, and like, they're willing to do so.
They're willing to do so. So, again, men on the Republican side certainly don't have the range.
No. So Trump suggested last week that he was fine with letting the ACA fail, but he then switched course and invited Republican senators to the White House to try to hash out a healthcare deal. And, you know, maybe this is because the Kaiser Family Foundation found that majorities across parties, say the GOP, like Trump camp, are responsible for any ACA problems going forward. So now it's like they're saying, okay, well, you can let it fail, but we're going to blame you. We see you. And this is your fucking fault.
Well, it's like Trump just wants a win, right? And so he's like, he's just acting like, again, I'm going to say petulant child. I think he's acting like a petulant child. He's like, we're just going to let it fail then. And then he's like, oh, wait, maybe we can't let it fail because people don't want it to fail. People rely, and it impacts people's lives.
Right. Like, and as soon as it came back to be pinned on him, that would be the reason it fails. All of a sudden, he's changing his fucking tune.
And I'm sure, like, Republican, you know, leaders are like, no. Like, we want to...
Well,
we get off on taking health care away from millions of people and to give tax breaks to the rich. Like, please, like, let us move forward. And, oh my gosh. Speaking of Trump, there was, like, a bananas interview that he did with Maggie Haberman of the New York Times.
And there was a whole behind the scenes thing, like unrelated, but they did a whole behind the scenes look at this interview. And if you need like a reason to throw things, please read it.
Yeah. And like, again, things are so wild that we can't even really talk about this interview in depth because it's just there's too much going on. But like, for me, one of the most galling things about this president, this so-called president, and this like healthcare, you know, initiative is that he literally has no fucking idea how health insurance actually works. Like, he in that interview in the New York Times, he claimed that it only costs $12 a year for health insurance when you're young. Like, I shit you not. That's what he said.
Like, but I think this is really a function of he's literally never had to think about it or deal with it. He has always had health insurance. He will always have health insurance. His family will always have health insurance. So he has no clue.
Yeah,
it's just...
There's definitely, like, a Bluth element there, you know, when they're like, how much could a banana cost? Like, $12 or something? There's definitely that, but also I think he just doesn't want to do the work. You know, when he's given briefings, we've been, you know, people have said, like, he needs it to be one page, he likes pictures. Again, he's a child.
Child.
He's a fucking child. But here is where it gets even more sort of, I don't know if interesting is the word, but this is another sort of complicated. Here's where it gets more complicated. So the Republican effort to move forward with their healthcare agenda has hit a snag also because John McCain recently announced, or his office recently announced, that he has been diagnosed with brain cancer. So he's currently in Arizona weighing treatment options. They don't really know how sort of involved he'll be or how long he'll be away from D.C. And this is, you know, sad news personally for McCain, and we do wish him well. But this especially puts the healthcare debate into a sharp perspective, I think, for me. Taxpayers pay public servants' salaries, and we also pay for their healthcare. So why the fuck do they want to take that away from us? Like, you know, John McCain's surgery that he had recently for that blood clot, if he were uninsured, according to Vox, that would have cost $76,000. Just that surgery, if he were uninsured. And that's more than the average annual household income in the United States.
Yeah. And there was also a really interesting sort of look. And they found that cancer patients with insurance outlive those without insurance and those on Medicaid.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a fact, backed up by research. Like, if you have insurance that is not Medicaid, you are more likely to live if you have cancer. And then that's also if you don't have insurance. You're more likely to live if you do.
Yeah, so. And that makes sense. That right. definitely makes sense, but it's backed up by research.
Yeah, and then, well, and so Republicans, not only this whole John McCain, you know, sort of snag, but on Friday, the Senate parliamentarian challenged key provisions that are needed to win conservative votes and to make the health care bill workable.
Yeah.
So the parliamentarian sort of serves as a referee, determining whether specific provisions of the bill comply with Senate rules. And one provision questioned by the parliamentarian who is Elizabeth McDonough, McDonough. And she's and it was a cherished amendment by the conservatives that would cut off federal funds for Planned Parenthood for 1 year. So another would prohibit the use of federal subsidies to buy insurance that includes coverage for abortions. And a third would penalize people who go without health insurance by requiring them to wait 6 months before their coverage could be begin. And that amendment was kind of fundamental to making this bill work.
Yeah.
So those were the three amendments that were questioned or challenged by the parliamentarian.
Yeah.
And these provisions appear to violate the Senate rules, which gives Democrats some leverage here. And if formally challenged, the provisions could survive only with 60 votes, which is a high bar to clear in this day and age, which is why McConnell opted for a reconciliation bill, because that only needs a simple majority.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 60 votes is going to be almost impossible for them. And, you know, let's credit where credit is due. According to Topher Spiro, it was actually Bernie Sanders' staff that were kind of crucial in punching, like, big holes in this bill. And arguing before the parliamentarian is intense and it requires a lot of prep work. So they really did their homework and they really got, you know, the parliamentarian to look at these amendments critically and could really, you know, like I just said, like, gives the Democrats some leverage here.
Yeah, that was, again, credit where it's due. I mean, that could be big, I think, for Democrats.
Oh, absolutely. And again, they picked reconciliation, which has very specific requirements and, you know, has to follow what is called the Byrd rule. And in order to avoid this 60 vote threshold. So if these provisions need 60 votes, there's no way they're going to survive.
Yeah.
No
and
way.
So then the bill, I think, then doesn't either isn't like conservative enough for these conservative voters,
right.
and or it won't work. Like, it just right. won't work in practice. So,
right, especially if they stay with reconciliation, which needs to lower the budget in order to be considered a reconciliation bill.
Yeah. So, again,
in order to do that, they need this fundamental sort of.
Yeah, there are trade offs, right? So, this is
right.
we're seeing what happens with when you try to go reconciliation.
Right.
So, just to remind everyone, the CBO estimated that under the GOP bill, about 22 million fewer people would have coverage by 2026 relative to the current law. And in a straight up just repeal bill would leave an estimated 32 million fewer people insured. So this is just a fucking disaster. No one wants
yeah.
this. Literally no one wants this except Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and Trump, because he just wants, like, a win.
Wants a win. He doesn't care.
Yeah.
I would also like to take a hot second that the difference between their repeal and quote replace bill and just the straight repeal is 10 million people, which is a lot of people, and
yeah.
they deserve health insurance. But that is not a huge spread. Like, their yeah. replacement is only 10 million people better
yeah.
than if they just repealed it. Like, that's really telling.
TLDR, it's a trash bill in every version.
It's a trash. This is like a dumpster fire of a bill.
Yeah. Can we also talk, just on a related note, because this story is kind of slipping below the radar, but it's, like, shady as fuck. So, according to the Daily Beast, so while this, like, repeal-replace bullshit is going on, the Daily Beast reported that the Trump administration has spent taxpayer money meant to encourage enrollment in the ACA. Instead, they're using it on a PR campaign that's sort of aimed at strangling it. So
right.
this effort, which includes a sort of multi-pronged social media push as well as video testimonials, that's designed at damaging public opinion of Obamacare. And that has caught the eye of legal experts and Democrats in Congress, because they're thinking that, you know, they want government agencies to investigate this because it could be the case that the administration has misused funds and engaged in covert propaganda in its efforts to sort of damage and undermine and overturn ACA.
Right. And what really is, I think, very scary and bothering about this is the Department of Health and Human Services' own website. So
yeah.
In the Obama administration, this sort of piece of online real estate featured direct links for consumers to apply for coverage and infographic breakdowns of the ACA's benefits and critical dates. And since Trump was inaugurated, it's been retrofitted into a basically bulletin board for information critical of the law. And you know, Sarah just said propaganda. And when a government agency uses government websites like this, it is straight up propaganda.
Yeah.
You know, they're not giving you information. They're literally telling you what to think about this bill.
Yep.
And that is dangerous. And when you, 'cause when you go to a government website, it has this like auspicious, like a official formal feeling. And when you use that space to push opinions on people and not just offer information, it's a slippery slope into like 1984 level propaganda bullshit.
Well, yeah, and all these Democrats and, you know, other people concerned with it, you know, and legal experts, what they're wondering is this a misuse of public funds? Like, they're right. Basically using taxpayer money to undermine, you know, a law that they're trying to repeal, but it's law right now, you know?
Right,
people,
exactly.
People need to use it. And on a related note, the Trump administration has also quietly ended ACA contracts that brought sign-up assistance to 18 cities. So,
cool. Fun.
Yeah.
And party.
We also learned from this article that people will have 45 days to shop for coverage in they'll have 45 days to shop for 2018 coverage, which starts on November 1st and ends on December 15th. But in previous years, they had twice that much time. So in every sort of little way, it feels like the Trump administration is really trying to make, you know, ACA fail. We talked about right. How it affected, like, insurance companies. Like, insurance companies were pulling out of ACA because they were not sure what was going to happen. Or they were pulling out of the marketplace because they weren't sure what was going to happen with the bill. And they weren't really... So it was kind of this, like, self-fulfilling prophecy of...
Right, which is, I think, why the Kaiser Family Foundation, you know, found that if the ACA fails at this point, it's on the GOP and Trump.
Yeah, and they said they found that majorities in both parties felt that way. So it's pretty right. clear to the public at large that Republicans are screwing the pooch every which way here.
Right.
So, yeah, we will definitely have some action items related to this. This is a really, yeah. I mean, I know we say it's a crucial week every week because it is, but truly this is a crucial, like, this is the week, it feels
the
like.
The week.
This is the week. So stay tuned for that at the end of the show. Okay, Devin, now that we've gone through some motherfucking healthcare, let's get into some Russia updates, because I mean, really, the Russia updates are becoming a semi-perma block as well. I mean, we keep saying that about like everything, but like we can't stop talking about Russia because there's too much bullshit going on, and it fucking matters. Don't let anyone tell you
matters.
It doesn't matter. It fucking matters.
If Russia is allowed to meddle in our elections and they're no longer free and fair, it doesn't really matter what the policy
everything
is.
Everything else is fucked.
Exactly.
Okay.
First up, Sessions discussed Trump campaign-related matters with the Russian ambassador, U.S. intelligence intercepts show. So basically, according to current and former U.S. officials, Russia's ambassador to Washington told his superiors in Moscow that he did discuss campaign-related matters, including policy issues important to Moscow, with Jeff Sessions during the 2016 presidential race. And a former official said that the intelligence indicates that Sessions and Kislyak had substantive discussions on matters, including Trump's positions on Russia-related issues and prospects for U.S.-Russia relations in a Trump administration. And that makes sense because, you know, Trump, the only thing he cared about in the Republican platform was pulling out the pro-Ukrainian plank.
Right.
So it makes sense that they would have this discussion about, you know, policy on Russia-related issues.
Yeah, and then so this is Kislyak. So the
right.
he was the Russia's ambassador to the U.S. You know, there were accounts of two conversations between Kislyak and Sessions, or the accounts of these conversations between Kislyak and Sessions were intercepted like Devin said, by U.S. spy agencies, which, you know, regularly monitor the communications of senior Russian officials in the U.S. and in Russia.
Right.
And one conversation was in April 2016, ahead of Trump's first major foreign policy speech, and another was in July 2016 on the sidelines of the Republican National Convention. And then Sessions...
Which is where he took out the pro-Ukrainian plank, was at the RNC.
Yeah, and Sessions had a third meeting with Kislyak in his Senate office in September 2016. And then officials, I guess, declined to say whether U.S. intelligence agencies intercepted any Russian communications describing the third encounter. But we know about this third encounter through reporting. So this right. is all to say, you know, this directly contradicts what Sessions has said publicly. You know, remember that he failed... He initially failed to disclose his contacts with Kislyak, and then said the meetings were not about the Trump campaign. He sort of tried to say that, oh no, it was in my capacity as a U.S. senator.
Right.
And so to couch this story just a little bit, you know, the U.S. officials who were talking about this sort of off the record, not off the record, but with an anonymity. They acknowledged that Kislyak could have mischaracterized or exaggerated the nature of his interactions with Sessions because, you know, Russian and other foreign diplomats in D.C. and elsewhere have been known at times to report or to, like, sort of be misleading or report false information to bolster their standing with their superiors or to confuse U.S. intelligence agencies. So these intercepts were between Kislyak and a superior.
Right.
So it wasn't between Kislyak and Sessions himself. So
right.
that sort of differs from what happened with Flynn, because Flynn was talking to Kislyak himself and was
and they got the direct sort of contents of that conversation.
Right.
So yeah.
But interestingly enough, U.S. officials with regular access to Russian intelligence reports say that Kislyak was known for accurately relaying details about his interactions with officials in D.C. So what they're saying is, like, he doesn't really have a history of, like, trying to mislead. Like, he's pretty...
Right.
What he says in these intercepts turn out to be pretty accurate. So, I don't know.
Right.
I would guess... I would put my money on the fact that Jeff Sessions is a fucking liar. That's what I would do.
Oh, 100%. I mean, Ted Lieu, who's Sarah's rep,
yeah.
he tweeted in response to this news, quote, "If this article is true, Lion Jeff Sessions should, at a minimum, be indicted for the felony of perjury. He also needs to resign." Like, just throw that in there. Like, get the fuck out of office. So I also love that he called him Lion Jeff Sessions.
Yeah,
like
I know he's like playing off Trump's like ridiculous nicknames. I mean, he needed to resign like
right.
yesterday. I mean, like
two
years ago, like before he even took office. Like he,
like just go away.
Yeah, just like preemptively resign. Like you are trash. But it's weird. There's like so much weirdness between Trump and Sessions, and it's hard to really know if it's like just Trump running his mouth, or if it's for show, or if it's real. Because in an interview last week, apparently Trump expressed frustration with Sessions recusing himself from the Russia investigation, and then sort of indicated regret at making him attorney general.
Oh, you know what? I think on this one particular issue, I agree wholeheartedly with Trump.
But it's hard to know if that's how he actually feels.
Right.
And, you know, when he was saying all this stuff, a lot of people were wondering, would this, you know, sort of force Jeff Sessions to resign, or would it make him be fired? But so far, Jeff Sessions is, like, holding on to Attorney General with his cold, dead hands. Like, he's just, like, has resisted resigning and says he intends to stay in the job as long as that is appropriate. So there's a lot of questions as to why this is going on. You know,
right.
Rachel Maddow always says, don't listen to what Trump says, just watch what they do. So you'll notice in our podcast, we don't quote Trump a lot, because I find that so he changes his mind so many times, he's spouting so much bullshit, it's really hard to keep track. I mean, it's good to reference when, you know, maybe they've contradicted themselves.
Right.
But in terms of, like, what he says, I have a hard time placing a lot of value, which is bananas to say. I have a hard time placing a lot of value on what the president of the United States says. But I try to watch...
We're limiting the upside down here.
I know. I try to look at more what he does. But here's a couple of different theories as to why Trump is sort of going after Sessions, at least verbally. So a lot of people think in getting rid of Sessions, Trump can replace him with an attorney general who will fire Robert Mueller. And the next story that we're going to talk about goes into sort of ways that the Trump administration is trying to undercut Mueller and his team. So that could make some sense to me.
Right.
But it's interesting because Sarah Kendzior, who has been on the show and we reference a lot, she thinks that Russia is really the one that it's pushing for Sessions to be replaced, sort of like in the background. Like they're the ones sort of like planting the seeds. Trump doesn't need a pretext for Sessions to be fired. He would do it if he really wanted to. I mean, see what happened to James Comey. Like,
right.
He found a way to fucking fire him. And Russia, like, she thinks it's in their interest to have the Mueller investigation stop because it affects their money ultimately. Replacing Sessions would be the quickest way to achieve that. So basically, it seems like people sort of feel that it is in Russian interests to replace Sessions. We don't know if it's coming, you know, if it's Trump sort of working with Russia or if it's just like Russia being like, hey, Trump, like, you're not working fast enough to get rid of this guy. And like, we're kind of scared of this Mueller guy. So it's hard to know. But because Sessions recused himself from the investigation, Rod Rosenstein, who is the deputy attorney general, that is Mueller's boss, technically. And that's who appointed Mueller. So Sessions doesn't have any power, really, to fire.
In the Mueller investigation.
Even though he, quote unquote, recused himself from Russia, but he really didn't. Well, that was sort of the pretext for firing Comey, you know?
Right. He got back involved saying, you know, Comey needs to go, which was a direct directly involved himself in Russia-related matters.
Because Comey was looking into Russia, even though they tried to make it about Clinton emails. Everyone knows it wasn't about that, but it doesn't matter.
That was such a Comey red herring that it wasn't even like...
Yeah.
Right. So kind of speaking of that, so in order to get Mueller out, Trump aides, I guess, are reportedly seeking leverage and are investigating Mueller's investigators in a very meta turn of events.
Very meta.
So Trump's lawyers and aides are scouring the professional and political backgrounds of investigators hired by special counsel Robert Mueller, looking for conflicts of interest they could use to discredit the investigation or even build a case to fire Mueller or get some members of his team recused from the investigation. And to seek a recusal, Trump's lawyers can argue their case to Mueller or his boss, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who Sarah just, you know, reminded us that he is in charge. He is Mueller's boss because Sessions recused himself from Russia-related investigations. And so this search for potential conflicts is pretty wide-ranging. It includes scrutinizing donations to Democratic candidates, investigators' past clients, and Mueller's relationship with Comey, whose firing as the FBI director is part of this special counsel investigation. And so the DOJ does have explicit rules about what constitutes a conflict of interest. Prosecutors may not participate in investigations if they have a, quote, personal or political relationship with the subject of the case. So, again, that's open to a little bit of interpretation, but it's pretty clear. And just interestingly, because they're looking at donations to Democratic candidates, making campaign donations is not included on the list of things that would create a, quote, political relationship. So just because you donate money to a candidate doesn't mean that you're, like, close personal associates of this candidate.
I mean, Trump used to donate to Democratic candidates. So, I mean, you could make the same...
So
if you
down.
Wanted to really go down that path, you'd be like, Trump, are you beholden to Hillary Clinton? Like, come on.
Right, exactly.
So some of the investigators have vast experience prosecuting financial malfeasance. And so the prospect that Mueller's probe could evolve into sort of an expansive examination of Trump's financial history has really stoked fears among his aides. And Trump is apparently especially disturbed after learning that Mueller would be able to access several years of his tax returns, which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's so telling. Like, the fact that he's so worried about it.
Yeah.
That little fire in my heart is like, we need to see him.
Uh-huh.
This is where it all is. Just like Rachel Maddow said, this is where it is. We got to get those tax returns.
Well, it's funny because according to Matthew Miller, who's a former DOJ spokesman, he said, quote, Mueller can get Trump's tax returns directly from the IRS without Trump ever knowing. He just needs a judge's approval in secret.
That's amazing.
I mean, Mueller's probe has expanded. And I feel like every other week we're talking about ways in which it's expanded and recently expanded to sort of look into Trump's business transactions. So Mueller has issued subpoenas to banks as well as he's filed requests for records to foreign leaders.
Foreign lenders,
excuse me, yeah. And
I Mueller, just like to say, like, Robert Mueller is one busy bee, man.
He really is. And he has a pretty sharp team as well.
Yes,
really well-respected. They've already begun examining financial records and have requested documents from the IRS related to former campaign manager Paul Manafort.
Right.
And they've also, federal investigators have also contacted Deutsche Bank about Trump's accounts, and the bank is expected. Yeah, Devin's really excited about that, and they are expected to comply. They're going to provide some information to Mueller.
Deutsche Bank, yes.
Yeah. And then Trump's
like, you will pull the pin on this. I know you will.
But Trump's legal team is also sort of in the midst of a shakeup. So lawyer Mark Kasowitz is out, and we didn't talk about him last week, but he sent some bananas emails to a random guy and told him like all this shit.
Like, I know where you live.
I know,
like,
where you
go
live, bitch,
fuck yourself, basically.
Yeah. So he's out, as well as the spokesman for that sort of team, Mark Corallo. So this is even more bananas. I can't believe this is just like a fucking footnote in this like other story. But we need to talk about this. So the Washington Post had also reported that Trump and his advisors had discussed in sort of recently. They've discussed his power to pardon aides, family members, and even himself in connection with the Russia investigation. Because that's fucking normal. That's
totally
what's normal these days.
Oh, yeah. Presidents just hand out pardons to, like, aides and family members. You get a pardon, and you get a pardon, and I get a pardon. Like, that's not how this works.
I mean, say what you will about Hillary Clinton. You know, 6 months into a presidency, she wouldn't be asking about what her power to pardon herself would be. And she wouldn't be doing that fucking ever. I just want to, like, put that into a little sharp perspective.
Right. Like put that out in the universe. And
yeah,
so the central question, though, is this even possible? Is this even possible? According to the Constitution, you know, that thing that our country is founded on, pardon authority extends to federal criminal prosecution, but not to state level or impeachment inquiries. So no president has ever tried to pardon himself. So no courts have ever reviewed it. So we're in uncharted territories here, uncharted waters. We're not dealing with good faith actors whose first priority is the health of our democracy.
Nope.
So we're not dealing with people who are like, what's the best way to, like, keep our country running? They're out for themselves.
This is why this is unprecedented. Like, no one has ever thought to pardon themselves, because they might have been dickwads in other ways, but they were good faith actors in terms of sort of the health of our democracy, and they had shame. Like,
right,
this guy has
That's a really good point.
Shame.
So, a president, the pardon power is pretty wide. They can pardon any individual at any point, including before the person is actually charged with the crime. And the scope of a presidential pardon can be very broad. So, President Gerald Ford, not Jimmy Carter, friends, learn that. So, Ford pardoned former President Nixon preemptively for offenses he, quote, committed or may have committed while in office. So, that's really broad. That's like, basically, we're not going to prosecute Nixon for anything.
Yeah.
It was basically what the pardon was.
Yeah.
So,
but that was another person. So, although it's very broad, there's a question of, you know, can you pardon yourself? And that is something, people have said it will probably have to go up to the Supreme Court.
Right.
And it's interesting because I remember Rachel Maddow asked, if Trump does pardon people, does he have to make that public? Like, you would think you would make it public, but you never know with these motherfuckers. They, like, keep everything secret. And she was talking to, I believe, a former lawyer in the Obama administration. And he said, the whole point of a pardon is that everyone knows that you're pardoned. So, that, like, you're free from whatever, you know, crime or possible crimes you may have committed or whatever. So,
federally,
like, that's
federally, not on the state level, which is important here.
Federally. So it's, like, inherent in the power of a pardon that people know that you've been pardoned. So that's kind of interesting. And we also have, we were going to go through some other bits and nibbles for Russia, but we're running long. And we're going to save that, I think, for Patreon. We're going to put it on Patreon. So if you're a Patreon Patreon contributor, we're going to go through some other Russia stories because there's some other shit going on that didn't even make the main show. We can't even talk about it.
We can't even do it. Although I will say one of the more bananas bits and nibbles we have in here is it was reported that ExxonMobil violated Russia sanctions while Rex Tillerson was CEO. We will definitely talk about that on Patreon, but let's put that out in the universe. That happened. That's a real thing that really happened.
So. Yeah, and we're like, we can't even talk about it. It's just like, there's too many other things going on. Okay, Devin, so let's get into our gratitude check. What are you grateful for today?
Okay, so first thing that I'm grateful for is Jennifer Lopez used a gender-neutral pronoun to describe her sister's second child in a post on Instagram. So the actress posted this picture on Instagram congratulating her sister's child on being selected to represent their school at the Global Young Leaders Conference. She said, quote, "This is Brendan, my sister Leslie's second child. They were the one person selected to represent their school at the Global Young Leaders Conference in Washington, D.C., and I couldn't be more proud. Brendan is a strong, smart, and loving, and obviously a leader. TT Jen loves you." So she was very careful with her word choice, and her fans were really openly impressed that she made sure to identify her family member in the correct way. And I really think personally that this is a really good piece of representation. Jennifer Lopez is just such a recognizable and popular celebrity, and her use of proper pronouns could, I mean, really influence her fans and people to be more careful in their word choice.
Yeah.
And I think this was just a great sort of instance of her respecting this child's identity.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a really sweet story.
And it's wild because it shouldn't be something that we like applaud. Like people should just do it, but it kind of exemplifies how much further we have to go. And it is important for someone as like famous as Jennifer Lopez to sort of lead by example.
Right. So that I thought that was really nice. So the second thing is actually something that happened at Comic-Con. Obviously, I'm also going to talk about Comic-Con a little bit. But John Lewis led a march of more than 1,000 people through Comic-Con after his panel on his graphic novel March. So I did not attend this panel, unfortunately. It was a huge panel, and the lines, Comic-Con and lines. But anyway, it was epic. So after the panel, he said to the crowd, quote, "Dr. King inspired me to get in trouble, what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. Now more than ever before, we all need to get in trouble. When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you have a moral obligation, a mission, and a mandate to stand up, to speak up, to speak out and get in trouble." And then he led this crowd through the floor and around the streets of San Diego, around the convention center.
Ugh, that's awesome.
Which is just awesome. And reportedly, not everyone recognized him.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, what? But those who did, I mean, people were coming up to him and thanking him and trying to shake his hand, and he was super gracious about it. And this is sort of what, you know, my friends and I call like con magic. So the best part about being around your people is that there are unscripted moments that build this community and make you feel like everything is going to be okay. People from all walks of life get together because they love a common thing. And anecdotally, I found that most people who attend cons are there because they felt alienated or ostracized from society. And they look for heroes who are different, who are ostracized, who are outright mutants. And this is what happens when people feel like they have community, like they have a voice and like they're represented. And John Lewis is a real life hero. And that he came to Comic-Con with the fictional ones is kind of this prime example of like con magic. And this impromptu march was, you know, just beautiful. And
he
amazing.
Has his own graphic novel. I mean, like, what does John Lewis not do? Like,
I know, right? And
what
it's
does he
great.
Not do?
That it yeah. is great.
And it's cool because I actually, someone responded to me on Twitter and said that they were registering people to vote at Comic-Con. I was like, that's so cool. Like, I just love like the intersection of like comics and politics. I think that's kind of your like sweet spot, Devin.
Right. Hey, like I said, if I could talk about comics and politics all day, that would be that's living my best life.
Yeah.
That's living my best life. My gratitude check was just being at Comic-Con in general, obviously, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Just being around people who are, for the most part, non-judgmental, who are, for the most part, there to support you. I did some cosplay. So, you know, I cosplayed as Marjorie Tyrell from Game of Thrones.
Ooh.
And yeah, it was super badass.
I loved Marjorie. I mean, I don't want to give any spoilers away for people who haven't seen Game of Thrones, but she was one of my favorite characters. Yeah.
Yeah, mine too. And she was just so like cunning and like
amazing.
Badass. Amazing. And so she, you know, so I and cosplay for me, it's like inherently a scary thing, you know, like putting on this costume and putting yourself out there to be judged. And what I found is that people at cons are, for the most part, incredibly supportive.
Yeah.
They want you to be there. They want you to feel included. They want you to feel beautiful. I actually went to a couple of panels about like body positivity and like just positivity in cosplay and how it can really affect your self-esteem.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just being around my people and, you know, being part of this like larger like movement of comic fans, of popular culture was just such an overwhelming and gratifying experience. So I am very grateful for Comic-Con.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, okay, Sarah, what are you grateful for this week?
Well, I didn't attend any like large conventions. but the first thing I'm grateful for is an organization called She Should Run. So they just launched a campaign to achieve gender parity in politics by 2030. So in 13 years. And their goal is to fill half of the country's 500,000 elected positions with women by 2030. I guess at our sort of current rates, you know, women are so so drastically underrepresented. It would take 100 years, but She Should Run is like, we have so much momentum. Like, let's just push it to 2030. Like, let's set an ambitious goal.
Right.
And, you know, the She Should Run's co-founder and CEO, Erin Luce Coltrero, said that post-election, more than 15,000 women have joined the She Should Run community, and 11,000 are actively planning to run for office. So it sort of,
oh my god,
goes along with the sort of larger trend of like women seem to be like really stepping up to the public service plate here. And she said, quote, "We're really taking advantage of this surge and saying now is our chance to build this path." So she's like, "We're not going to wait 100 fucking years, all right? Let's like set a goal by 2030 to achieve some gender parity." And yeah, according to, according to Coltrero, one of the biggest issues for women candidates is that they second guess themselves, which I am well acquainted with that. And so with that in mind, this, you know, campaign will pair campaign veterans, be they lawmakers, activists, or journalists, with aspiring candidates, so sort of like a mentorship thing. They're going to create a community referral program that connects women with resources close to home, and they're going to also expand their online incubator program and create online content tailored to each woman's needs. So they're really building up like a robust enterprise and, you know, shooting for the stars here. They're like, we're not going to wait 100 years. Let's see what happens in 13.
Right. And I also love that this is sort of what I was talking about building community, like with Comic-Con or anything else. Like when you create these communities, like, and empower people, amazing things can happen.
For sure. For sure. So I love that. I'm all about women in politics. The second person I'm grateful for is Danica Rome. So she's a Democrat who is also a transgender former journalist who is challenging Virginia delegate Robert Marshall in Prince William County. So she has outraised her opponent by 20x in the month of June. So she's like killing it. So in June, she raised $85,637, and then he only raised $4,585. To couch it a little bit, there was a couple of like really big donations that went to her campaign, but and there is a lot of outside money coming in, but still, that is amazing. Like, it's really amazing. Awesome. And she's awesome. She's pushing to be the first openly transgender person elected in Virginia. And, you know, Marshall, this 14-term incumbent, is sort of really diametrically opposed to her. She's deeply conservative and anti-LGBT. And he's like, you know, he's been elected, or he's served in that seat for 14 terms, like I said. So I think he feels like, oh, I'm probably safe. Like, I've been elected 14 times. She was like, oh, no, I'm going to outraise your ass by 20x in the month of June.
Fuck winter, Democrats are coming.
And yeah, she said, quote, "We're building a campaign that can win, and we don't have to sell out our values to do it. I'll be able to demonstrate through governing that a transgender person who has in-depth knowledge about the public policy issues affecting her district and has long-standing ties to her community can succeed in politics and government. So I'm like, yes, like I love that confidence.
Love that.
Flippable, who we talk about a lot on the show, they've actually targeted this seat as a place Democrats can win. I think they were one of the ones that made a pretty large donation to her. And they are definitely focused heavily on Virginia in 2017. Nearly two-thirds of Virginia's state house is Republican, but the state went blue in the 2008, 2012, and 2016 elections. So definitely some motherfucking gerrymandering up in there. But
seriously.
But yeah, so they think that they can sort of help flip Virginia blue. And Danica is one of the people that can help do that. So I love that. Devin, let's get into some listener gratitude checks.
All right, yeah, let's do it. So the first one is from a listener, Katie. She said, "My gratitude check is personal and political. I'm grateful for my Congresswoman, Catherine Clark, who is fighting every day for women and girls. She has introduced bills focused on online harassment, doxing, and revenge porn. It's not always the most glamorous or headline-grabbing legislation, but it's so important, and she's a consistent champion. I'm thrilled that she represents me."
And so Katie, so I'd left out some sort of like identifying information because I wasn't sure if she felt comfortable with us saying so, but she said she did. She also said in her gratitude check that Catherine Clark is also her boss, so she works for her, and she's like thrilled to be able to work for her too. So in our outline, I just wanted to be on the safe side, but she said it was okay, and so that's awesome. Great. She gets an awesome representative and an awesome boss, so that's really cool. Jesse said, quote, "After working on an issue campaign for 2016 and then a couple projects for the most recent Colorado legislative session, I'm starting a new full-time position on Monday, so today, as a senior communications associate for a nonprofit working for Access to End-of-Life Options. I got laid off in 2015, and it's been rough on and off, so I'm super grateful and excited for this new adventure, helping people access a different kind of healthcare. Also, gratitude check worthy, all of my bosses are kick-ass ladies."
I love that. That's amazing. So Kimberly said, quote, "My son just registered for his last semester of college. He also accepted an amazing post-graduation job. Seeing him be able to use his education to do a job he will love is amazing. Neither his father nor I have degrees, so being able to help him get one is a huge deal for both of us."
That is awesome. That's so beautiful. And then Maureen said, "I'm grateful for supportive communities on the internet. I posted in the Hellbent Facebook group about feeling nervous about my marathon because I've been dealing with a bunch of bullshit and too many dickwads in my life. I got so many wonderful and supportive replies, which made me feel totally capable. Honestly, there were happy tears while reading those comments." I love that.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Hellbent is the best thing I've ever done with my time.
Yeah.
And, you know, this community has given me so much.
Yeah.
So I'm tearing up a little bit.
Yeah, it's awesome to hear that it's been reciprocal for a lot of people. So yeah, if you want to give us any of your gratitude checks, you can tweet us at HellbentPod. You can email us hellbentpodcastla@gmail.com. We think we want to keep including them in our podcast. All right, Devin, let's get into the Donald Trump dishonor in dickwatery. And we're already at about an hour. And we know we keep trying to say we're going to do a tight, like, hour, 5 minutes. It's just not going to happen today. There are just too many dickwads.
There are a lot of dickwads.
So we have some dishonorable mentions. Our first dishonorable mention, and it is, I'm sad to have to say this, is Chuck Schumer.
This is a disappointing one.
Yeah.
It's disappointing.
I gotta howl at the moon at Chuck Schumer. Howling at the moon.
The moon.
So, Chuck Schumer sent a thinly veiled message to Hillary Clinton this weekend saying, quote, "You blame yourself, quote, if you lose to somebody who has 40% popularity." So he's referring to Trump. And I am just so over men, especially dudes on our side of the aisle, unnecessarily shitting on Hillary. Still, like 8 months after the election. What the fuck does that accomplish? Like, honestly, like, I get it. It's much easier to place like all the blame on the woman than it is to face up to facts. Like, I get it. It's so much easier to just fully scapegoat her and say it's all her fault, nothing else, than it is to sort of address sort of complex truths.
Right.
Which,
it's very frustrating. And it's like, Please do not contribute to the dumpster fire, Chuck Schumer.
Yeah.
Like, there is enough of it going around already. Please stop.
Well, and just sort of speaking of facts, you know, capital F, capital A, capital C, capital T, capital S, just in case, you know, they don't know what we're talking about. It's facts. Let's talk about some facts. Let's talk about some complex truths that sort of contradict these, like, overarching media narratives that we keep hearing about how horrible Hillary was and how she didn't connect with voters and yada, yada, yada. Here's some well-sourced facts from yours truly, Hellions. So when Hillary Clinton resigned as Secretary of State in 2013, her approval rating was 69%, which made her the most popular politician in America. But then when she ran for president, her favorability rating sank to 40%, which I'm sure had absolutely nothing to do with being a woman and having the audacity to ask the country for a promotion. I'm sure that had nothing to do with it.
It was about her emails, okay?
She's just flawed. She's just a flawed
candidate. She's just flawed.
It's just flawed. That's all. Also, according to 538, in late October, so right before the election, more Democrats voted affirmatively for Hillary Clinton than they did sort of against Donald Trump. So their vote was like for her. Like more Democrats were like, I'm voting for her rather than against Donald Trump. While on the flip side, more Republicans voted against Clinton than affirmatively for Trump. So like when people say, oh, people didn't like Hillary or they didn't know what her message is. People liked Hillary and knew what her message was. They voted for her. And that was like pretty in line with averages for, you know, Democratic candidates going back to the 80s. So just saying. Also, Clinton won the working class as a whole. Why do people gloss over this? Like, I know people are obsessed with the white working class. She won the working class as a whole. She won the under 30,000 bracket and also the 30,000 to 50,000 bracket. And for all the talk of Trump's populist appeal, it was Clinton's economic message that voters preferred in nearly every swing state. And that includes the decisive Rust Belt. And across the country, every state, voters preferred her economic message.
Yeah.
Lest we forget, Clinton also won the popular vote by 3 million, which is a wider percentage margin than some past presidential winners, including John F. Kennedy. So those are just the tip of the iceberg. That's just some facts, okay? Like, when people say they didn't know what Hillary stood for, or that it's all her fault, or that all this stuff, they're discounting all these things that sort of paint a more complex truth about this election. And I think a lot of it is people don't want to own up to the fact that Trump voters are racist and sexist.
Oh, 100%.
Like, you can't have voted for Trump and not at least have rubber stamped a bigoted agenda. You are complicit in that.
Yeah, and you can say what you want about economic policy and taxes and blah, 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 blah. Please shut your fucking mouths and, you know, just admit that you are okay with this. If you're going to be an asshole, own it. Like, don't hide.
I just don't like Democrats leaning into this narrative. Like, I don't understand what we gain from sort of a posture of self-loathing, like, oh, we suck, we couldn't even beat Donald Trump. That doesn't help anybody. That really doesn't help. Like, I'm all for criticism that's constructive. This doesn't feel constructive. It feels self-defeating. And I'm just, you know, Hillary was up against unprecedented obstacles. First, it was a patriarchal system, you know, that has shut women out of executive power, an FBI director interfering at the 11th hour, and a foreign power hacking our fucking election, probably with some help from Trump's campaign. So, like, you try accomplishing all that shit backwards and in motherfucking heels, and then get back to me. That's all I'm saying.
Seriously. No, it's awful. And you know, no one is saying, including us, we're not saying that Clinton ran a perfect campaign, but no one ever runs a perfect campaign. Yep. That's not a thing. So, you know, it's been 8 months since the election, and dudes, including the goddamn Senate Minority Leader, Chuck fucking Schumer, are still using Clinton as their fucking punching bag.
Yeah.
It's lazy, and I'm over it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just, stop. You know, not just because, you know, Sarah and I both supported Hillary Clinton, but because of, like, these narratives that we allow Republicans to set, and then also what that foretells for our next potential female presidential nominee.
Yeah.
Like, if we're shitting on Clinton 8 months after the election, that does not bode well for
the future.
Kamala Harris.
Because it's not Kamala just Harris, about 2020. Kamala Harris, remember. It's Kamala. And yeah, and I've already seen people preemptively tear down Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and even, yes, Elizabeth Warren. So this isn't about Hillary. This is how we treat women, and saying that how Hillary was treated was okay. And it's not okay. And I just want to quote at Einstein's Trom. She said, quote, hey, elected Dems, you see how Maxine Waters got incredibly popular by relentlessly attacking Trump and never going after Clinton? Try that. Which is just so true. It's like, that's... Go with that playbook. Anyway, that's Seriously. Our little soliloquy on Chuck Schumer. We were disappointed, but we had to howl at the moon at him, because that is some bullshit, and it's worth that pushing is. Back on. Our second dishonorable mention is Game of Thrones showrunners David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. So they announced a new project for HBO, which is an alternate history series called Confederate. And the premise of the show is a fictional timeline where the South succeeded in seceding from the Union. And then in this version of the United States, or like what's become of it, slavery has remained legal and has continued into the modern era. Which is like, why? Why are you creating a show like this?
Right. And Benioff, responding to the criticism, said, quote, "So everything is brand new and nothing's been written. I guess that's what was a little bit surprising about some of the outrage. It's just a little premature. You know, we might fuck it up, but we haven't yet." To which I say, fuck you.
That's like,
it's also super disappointing because David Benioff and D.B. Weiss are great showrunners. And, you know, Game of Thrones is amazing. So
Game of Thrones is problematic in a lot of ways. I love Game of Thrones. Watch it.
That's true.
But it's not like they have a clean track record here. And it's like, it's probably not the best position to be in when trying to sell a new show. Like, we know the subject matter is offensive to many people, but they haven't even given us a chance to fuck up yet, which we probably will.
Which we probably will. Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think, you know, Roxane Gay, you know, she tweeted, quote, it is exhausting to think of how many people at HBO said yes to letting two white men envision modern day slavery, and it's offensive. And I thought also Clint Smith made an interesting point. He said, quote, "Instead of making a show like Confederate, I'd really love to see someone turn Du Bois' Black Reconstruction into a television series. There's so much to be said about what actually happened after the Civil War instead of the myths that we're taught. That's the show I want." And I think that's really interesting. I think we are taught a lot of myths about the Civil War, and we don't know the real history of what happened before, during, and after.
It's steeped in a lot of lore.
It is. You know, it really
in a lot
is.
Of lore and, like, fictional or quasi-fictional accounts of what happened. So, having an actual historically accurate show would be pretty bomb.
Yeah. And it's interesting because producers Nichelle Tramble Spellman and Malcolm Spellman apparently deleted their Twitter accounts once they recognized the backlash. But they said that as Black creatives, they understand the concerns. And Nichelle said, quote, "I think that the four of us are very thoughtful, very serious, and not flip about what we are getting into in any way." But I don't know. I mean...
Yeah, I don't know.
I like what Yesha Callahan from The Root wrote. She said, quote, "People are still scratching their heads over the concept of the show, especially at a time when relics of the Confederacy are now being taken down in the South. And it's not as if we're living in a post-racial society. And yes, we all know about shows like Man in the High Castle, Confederate States of America, and the countless books written. Just don't assume that everyone wants an alt version of things people still have to deal with in real life. You know, like subjugation." So that's kind of...
And it is a path. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I think that just sort of neatly wraps up why it's, you know, so hard for people and so harmful and so offensive.
Right. Absolutely. And it's like, an HBO, especially the showrunners of Game of Thrones, which is so wildly popular, they do wield a lot of, like, pop culture power.
Yeah.
And so for them to sort of, you know, want to make this show and to say, like, oh, you know, we're going to make another hit with this, it's very problematic. It's very upsetting.
Yeah.
So...
Who's our next dishonorable mention?
Okay, so the next dishonorable mention is a last-minute ad. A guy named Ashley E. Miller. He's a writer for TV and movies, I believe. So I went to a panel at Comic-Con called Starship Smackdown. It was the very last panel on the last day that I went to, and my friends told me that it was just, like, hilarious and a must-see. So basically what it is a bunch of, quote, starshipologists that debate which fictional starship is the best, which I love that premise. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
But when they introduced the panel of seven, it was five white men, one Puerto Rican man, and one woman. And this was not particularly surprising, but annoying, to say the least.
Yeah.
But anyway, so each panelist nominates a ship to debate, and the one woman, Kay Rendell, nominated the TARDIS. And the rest of the panel challenged her, saying that the TARDIS was not a starship, which we can get into it, but it is. It's fine.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. What was problematic about it, though, was that the rest of the panelists were vicious about it.
In particular, Ashley E. Miller, this guy, was particularly awful to her. I mean, she pointed out that her choice was the only one that was challenged.
Of course.
And then because, yeah. And then they wanted to add an asterisk next to it because it, quote, wasn't really a starship, but okay, fine, we'll add it in there.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So she threatened to walk off and, in fact, got up and walked away from her seat. And to his credit, Jose Molina, who's the Puerto Rican man, got up and was going to walk off with her. She pointed out that if they both left, the panel would be entirely white dudes.
Oh, my God.
So they decided generously to not put an asterisk next to the TARDIS. So she and Molina came and sat back down. And the reason why it's Ashley E. Miller in particular was because when it came time to debate the TARDIS, he just kept saying, well, it's not a starship. Like, cars then are starships
because
they
travel
through. Yeah. Well, actually. And the entire panel was so stereotypical white dude nerds are the only real nerds.
Yeah.
That I thought for like a hot second that it was like some long performance art joke.
No.
But it was not. Kay's opinions were dismissed and she was interrupted and talked over, and they really just ignored her when she tried to add to the debate. And Ashley E. Miller was the absolute worst. He was trying to be like funny, I guess.
Ugh.
But he was just so mean and openly misogynistic that I was genuinely shocked. And it was a real time lesson in what it is still like in 2017 to be a woman in a male dominated industry.
Oh yeah. It's still trash.
Oh, it's trash. It was so upsetting. And I honestly, I should have walked out. I wanted to walk out when they started challenging the TARDIS, but I should have.
Yeah.
But more con magic, as I was talking about earlier, I tweeted Kay Rundell during the panel and she responded that she was a fan of the podcast. I asked her if she was a listener before I reached out and she said that she's been listening since the beginning.
Oh my gosh.
So
shout out to Kay.
Kay, if you're out there, you're amazing. You're a saint, and I'm sorry that was such a trash panel.
Yeah.
And the TARDIS is totally a starship. I'm with you there.
We've got your back, Kay.
We've got your back.
And also that guy, Molina, had her back, which is just so telling, you know?
Yes, it really is.
It's just so telling. White dudes, be better. Step up.
Be better. Stop being so awful. So, okay, Sarah, who is our winner, our loser of the week? Loser of the week.
Again, I mean, it could really go to anyone any given week.
Anyone.
And there's just so many ridiculous stories, but we felt that Paul Congemi, a mayoral candidate in St. Petersburg, Florida, would be the Donald Trump Dishonor and Dick Watery award loser. So I'm just going to read the lead of this Washington Post article because it's wild. And so just so you can get a sense. Quote, Paul Congemi insists that he doesn't want all black people to go back to Africa, just a specific group of black people who have been trying to make reparations a political issue in St. Petersburg, and who, he said, heckled him at a mayoral forum in the Florida city.
Oh, thank God. I thought he was going to be a little bananas, but, you know, that's just...
Oh, thank God. Thank you for saying it's not all black people. I was worried you were going to be racist. Now that you're just saying a specific group, I know you're not racist, because that's what not racist people totally say.
Yeah, well done, white dude.
So... Oh, my God. Obviously, like, this is horrifying. Congemi was speaking to Jesse Neville, who is a white campaign opponent who heads a group calling for reparations for African Americans. And this is where it gets even more offensive. Congemi said, quote, the reparations that you talk about, Mr. Neville, your people already got your reparations. Your reparations came in the form of a man named Barack Obama.
Ugh, excuse me while I go throw up in my mouth forever.
He was like, we elected one black president, therefore everything is fine. Everything is fine.
Right.
Why are you asking for shit? Those are your reparations. Oh my God. He also added, quote, my advice to you, if you don't like it here in America, planes leave every hour from Tampa Airport. Go back to Africa. Go back to Africa. Go back. But he really wants to think he's racist, that's for sure, but he is.
Of course not.
Then this dickwad tried to say that he, quote, has nothing against African Americans who are doing their best here in America. Again, he says he's only going after a specific group, therefore he's not racist. And it's like, sir, you are mistaken. This is pretty fucking racist.
This is pretty fucking racist.
Neville's campaign is backed by Uhuru Solidarity Movement, which also believes reparations can begin to mend racial inequality. Neville has also highlighted other racial issues, including gentrification and police violence against minorities. His campaign slogan is, quote, unity through reparations.
Neville says that he sees paying reparations and rectifying other race-based disparities as the first steps to healing many class and social issues. And in fact, a UN panel last year declared that the United States owed African Americans reparations for the country's history of, quote, enslavement, racial subordination and segregation, racial terrorism, and racial inequality.
Congemi told the Post he was a lifelong Democrat who switched allegiances after then-President Barack Obama came out in favor of same-sex marriage, which unsurprisingly was then followed by, quote, I'm not politically correct. So that's just like the trifecta of like racist white asshole. It's just like, I'm not politically correct. Like, oh my God, it's just ridiculous. Okay.
And
then, you know, just because of course not, this wasn't his first instance of dickwadery either. When he was running for mayor in 2009, he got into a shouting match with KFC employees, then told the police on the scene, don't touch me, I'm running for mayor, and once I get elected, you will be fired.
Why is it that all of our dickwad losers are, this is never their first rodeo?
Oh no, because they're lifelong dickwads. It's like a membership badge. You know, like they need to wear like dickwad membership only jackets like that.
Seriously.
So we're going to give the Dickwad of the Week award to Paul Congemi just like for everything that we said. I mean, it's awful. Just all awful.
All right, Sarah. So last but not least, let's get into some action items, some things that, you know, our listeners can do. Y'all can do once you're done listening to the show. So first up. Healthcare. This is the fucking week.
Yeah.
Sarah, you want to take us through that?
Yeah, so like we said, the Senate is apparently going to take some kind of vote as early as Tuesday, but no one knows what fucking version of the bill it's going to be, which is bananas.
It's bananas.
And Topher Spiro actually tweeted last week, quote, we're hearing from Republican sources that calls into Capito and Murkowski recently swung from anti-repeal to pro-repeal. So those are two of the women who sort of, along with Collins, were like, No, just repeal plan. We need a replacement as well. So especially if you live in West Virginia or Alaska, call until they're sick of hearing from you and then call some more.
Yeah, we should all be lighting up our senators' phone lines. If you go to TrumpCareToolkit.org, which is part of the Indivisible sort of package, it's a great resource, especially for constituents whose senators are on the fence and or in vulnerable seats.
Is that Indivisible's stuff? I thought it was a separate thing. Okay.
No, it's part of Indivisible, and it's always a great place to turn.
Yeah, like, just
Indivisible in general.
Yeah, for sure.
The second thing is to support Little Miss Flint. In 2016, she successfully collected over 100 backpacks for the nonprofit Pack Your Back, and this year she's looking to do it again for the organization.
Yeah, she's raising money to do so and is about halfway to her 2,500 goal. So you can go to classy.org/team/126933. Again, we'll have this in our show notes, but you can go there to donate to the cause.
Woo, Sarah, that was a long packed episode.
Yeah, it was long. We keep promising it's not going to be as long and we keep lying. We're sorry.
We're sorry.
We're so sorry. But we, you might have noticed that Devin and I were not together. So there might have been some times when, you know, we were talking over each other because Skype, man,
Skype's hard.
It's a little hard.
Yeah, we were like, I think we might be out of sync and my iPad froze. It's been a journey.
It's been a journey this episode. Yeah, it's been a journey. But we will be back together on Thursday. We have a really exciting guest. We're so, so pumped to talk to her. So if you're on Patreon, you'll be able to find out first. But we think everyone's going to really enjoy the conversation. So thank you for supporting us. Thank you for listening. Patreon contributors, we'll see you soon with a bonus podcast. And everyone else, we'll see you back on Thursday.
On Thursday. For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we've discussed as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. You can follow Devin on Twitter at DevinHandy, and you can follow Sarah on Twitter at Sarah Lerner.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/hellbentpodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent. And there are lots of other fun rewards for higher levels of patronage, including a monthly Skype session with Devin and Sarah.
And for that one, drinking is optional.
Optional.
quote unquote.